nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So today I'd like to continue our discussion of spin. And as I mentioned, this basic framework that we have discussed in this course for thinking of current flow, that consists of the idea that you have a channel, you have a Hamiltonian, and you have these sigmas which describe the connection to the contact. And if you take its anti-Hermitian part, that's this gamma, which tells you how easily electrons escape in and out. And these are all matrices. And when you want to include spin into your description from a calculational point of view, in terms of operationally, all that happens is the matrices get twice as big. Twice as big because conceptually it's like if your original device had, say, 3 points in it, your matrices were all 3 by 3. Now what happens is each point has an up component and a down component. And so all matrices become like 6 by 6. It just gets doubled. That's about it. And if you write the matrices correctly, then the equations we have talked about, those will get you all the right answers. Okay? But as I've often stressed again, calculating something and understanding something are two different things. Of course, it's important to know exactly how to calculate it, but then you have to spend a lot of time trying to understand what it is you're calculating, right? And what I've been trying to do in the last couple of lectures then is we're trying to understand what this additional thing, spin, really represents. How do you visualize it? How do you understand it, etc.? Okay. So one of the examples that I started with, which is a very concrete experimental fact. And that is that when you take a device and make two contacts, and these are magnetic contacts, and they're both in the same direction, parallel, you get more current through the device than if it's anti-parallel. So if you reverse one of the magnets, you get less current. And this is a very important established experimental fact. As I said, there are real devices based on this that are used. It's called the giant magnetoresistance resistance effect. Okay. And this, as I said, to understand how this comes about from our formalism or how we do it, as I said, to understand this, even what we discussed in September was good enough. In the sense that the basic thing is that you have an upspin channel and a downspin channel, and the difference now is that you have contacts such that the upspin can come out a little easier than the downspin. So let's say here you have an alpha and a beta. So alpha tells you the rate at which upspin wants to come out. Beta tells you the rate at which downspin wants to come out. On the other hand, when you go to the other contact, if it's parallel, then again, it's the same ratio because then both contacts are the same. But if it's anti-parallel, then it's the role of beta and alpha are reversed. And just using this idea, as we discussed, you can see why the resistance would be different in the two configurations. Okay? That's the idea. Now, in terms of our matrix formalism that we have now, the way you would get it is, well, for contact one, the gamma looks like a matrix with alpha and beta on the diagonals. That's how upspin gets out. That's how downspin gets out. If it's parallel, gamma two also looks the same. And if it's anti-parallel, then gamma two looks just the opposite, with alpha and beta reversed. And this will give you exactly the same answers, the matrix method and the other one. But of course, the matrix method takes you much further in the sense, and this is what we were discussing last day, that what if this magnet is neither parallel nor anti-parallel, but say something like this, somewhere in between. How do you do that? And this is where what I tried to describe last day is that if you accept one thing, then you can understand all the other results. And that has to do with this basic thing, that spin for electrons, the nearest analogy to something you have heard of before would be polarization for light. So with light, you think of the electric field as being in a certain direction, a vector that describes the polarization of the photon or light. Electron spin is like its polarization. And the difference is that when you think of the photon polarization, you think of the electric field, which is a standard vector. And the components of a vector you write as an x component, a y component, and a z component. And if you had a vector that was pointing in a certain direction, theta phi, where theta is the angle in the zx plane and phi is the angle in this xy plane, then you could write them this way. With spins, there are two components, up and down. Just two components. And you might say, well, how can I represent something that needs three components with just two? Well, the thing is, the additional feature you now have is it's complex. These were all real, but this is complex. And for a given theta and phi, this is how you would write it. Okay. Now, if you accept this, and this is, of course, not meant to be obvious, but I'm saying if you accept this, then there's nothing new else that you need to accept. Everything else will follow. Right? And what I'll try to get at the end of today's class, I think, I'll try to explain a little bit as to where this one came from. Okay? But the point I'm trying to make first is that if you accept this, everything else really fits in. Okay? And the way I described one of the things last day is how you'd use this. Well, if you had a magnet like this, pointing in some arbitrary direction, how do I write its gamma? Well, the idea is if you use a spin in this direction as your basis, then it will look like alpha, beta, 0, 0, as long as you use the spin in this direction. But then you have to transform it back to the basis in which you're using spins in this direction. And when you transform it, how do you transform it? You put this U and U dagger in front and back, and that's where you'll need to make use of this fact. Because when you try to write those transformation matrices, you have to write your new basis in terms of the old basis. And that's where you need that. But if you do that, then that's how it will work. And then we went through an example of, let's say your contacts are fixed. So, no mysteries about the contacts. They're both in the same direction. Let's say we have a parallel contact. Now, if you actually put a magnetic field inside here, then you can change the current. And that is, again, also a demonstrated experimental fact. It's called the Handle effect. People have seen this. That in a device with magnetic contacts, when you put a magnetic field here, as you turn up the magnetic field, you can make the current oscillate. It will change. Now, to understand that, how do you model that? Well, if the contacts are fixed, then gamma 1, gamma 2, you have no... these are fixed. There's no latitude there. Where does the magnetic field enter? Well, it changes your Hamiltonian itself, the H. Now, how do you change the Hamiltonian? Well, if you think of that simplest level, which has just two states in it, then ordinarily without any magnetic field, let's say it looks like this. And for this discussion, we can ignore this part. I mean, we could just take our epsilon as zero. So this isn't even, we don't even have to worry about this. This out. But what a magnetic field does is, if a magnetic field happens to be in the z direction, then it makes one of these higher energy than the other. So one of them goes up by mu b times bz, the other one goes down by mu b times bz. Now I might say, well, what if I had a magnetic field in the x direction? And what we went through last day is, I said, if you use the x direction as your basis, then it will still look exactly like this. 1, 0, 0, minus 1. As long as you use x as your basis. So it's like left. So your basis functions are plus x and minus x. Actually, let me just write plus x and minus x. That may be clearer. So if you use plus x and minus x as your basis, it will look like this. Just as for bz, it looks like this for if you use plus z and minus z as your basis. But then, of course, everything needs to be in the same basis. So what you do is convert this back to plus z and minus z. And the way you do that is, you first put a matrix like this in front, where plus x is expressed in terms of z and minus z, and that is 1, 1. And the minus x is expressed in terms of z and minus z, that's what's minus 1, 1, etc. And I get with it, I think it's divided by 1 over root 2. This went through last day. And then you put a matrix on this side, which is just the opposite. That is, it's x and minus x here, and then z and minus z here. But then this matrix is just the conjugate transpose of this one. So you can write that. And then if you multiply it out, that's what we went through last day, you get that matrix. So what that tells you is that when you put a magnetic field in the x direction, it will actually not enter the diagonals like this. It will actually enter in the off diagonal when expressed in the z basis. It's an important thing. And if you put something in the y direction, it will look like this. That again, one can go through. The difference now will be we're doing it in y, so this matrix will be a little different, etc. But all this then follows if you accept this one. Because how would I write this matrix? I'd say, okay, what does x look like in terms of z and minus z? Well, this is what it tells me. This is what tells me the answer, that x means theta is equal to 90 degrees, phi is equal to 0, so this drops out. Theta is 90 degrees, so cosine 45, sine 45, that's how I get the 1, 1, etc. Okay, yeah. Mu b. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So actually, this mu b that I wrote here, that's called the Bohr magneton, right? Which is actually a fundamental constant. Mu b by itself, the expression is q h bar over 2m, and its units are actually ampere square meter. It's like magnetic moment. So it's, if you think of a little current loop, ampere times the area. The current that's going around times the area, that's what this is. And it's about 10 to the minus 23 ampere square meter. That's a fundamental constant. You can put that in. Now, in actual materials, which I didn't bring in, is the answers could be a little less than this, or in some materials can be a whole lot bigger than this. And that is something people put in by something called the G factor, which is different in different materials. So what I wrote here is what you'd get if the electron were in vacuum. And in lots of semiconductors, it is almost that. But actually, though, it is could be much bigger than that, and in some cases somewhat less than that, may have even the opposite sign, etc. In real materials, just as the mass of an electron in a real material is often different from what it is in vacuum. I mean, mass in the sense of effective mass. Similarly, it's like there's an effective Bohr magneton here in a solid, which can be different from what it is elsewhere. Okay. But for any material, those are things that are well known, have been studied. We know all the information's all there, what it should be. Okay. So now, these three matrices, by the way, are very often used in this literature on spin, and they're called the Pauli spin matrices. So this is usually defined as sigma x. This is sigma y. And this is sigma z. These are called the Pauli spin matrices. And of course, these days, if you want to find it, you can just Google it. There'll be, you know, you'll have a nice tutorial pages describing all this. You can look it up anytime. Okay? So those are the Pauli spin matrices. And often people write what I wrote here in shorthand like this. You see, this is sigma x, and this is sigma y, and this is sigma z. So you could write it as bx sigma x plus by sigma y plus bz sigma z, which they then write in shorthand notation as mu b sigma dot b. Because the implication is when I take the dot product of two vectors, A dot B. It is AX BX plus AY BY plus AZ BZ. So here it's like sigma X BX plus sigma Y BY plus sigma Z BZ. And so that's what this is. So this is like a shorthand notation for this. Okay? And you'll see that often in the literature. Now, one thing that happens in a magnetic field, and this is this origin of the Hanley effect that I mentioned, is that supposing we call, so this direction that I've mentioned here, let's say this is the x direction. And supposing I put a magnetic field in the z direction here, like this. Then what happens is, this spin will want to rotate around that magnetic field. So if you have a magnetic field perpendicular like this, then as it goes, so when you inject it, let's say an electron comes in with up spin, as it goes through the device, it will gradually rotate, etc. If you put a magnetic field this way. So whatever direction the magnetic field, it will rotate around it. So what that means is, yeah, as it rotates, of course, if it happens to line up along this, you'll get a lot of current out of it. On the other hand, if it's in the opposite direction, it won't come out. You won't get as much current. So what you expect to see then, if this effect is there in a device, is that when you put a magnetic field, the current will gradually oscillate as a function of the magnetic field. And that's actually been observed. People have done experiments in the last 5 years. These are all experiments done recently, actually, a lot of it. Although in metals, the experiments are more like 10, 20 years old. But now they've also done it in semiconductors like silicon. Okay. So that's called the Hanley effect. The magnetic field, you can rotate this thing. Now, so what I'll try to explain to you is why in a magnetic field the spin rotates. How do you understand that? No, I just stated that as a fact. Point is, how does it come out of the math? Because mathematically or calculationally, as I've said, if you know how to write these H's and sigmas, you don't have to assume it. I mean, it all will come out of that. As I said, as far as calculations are concerned, there's nothing more to it. It's just a matter of understanding why. Okay? Now, the way you think about this is, let's say I've put a magnetic field in the Z direction. Now, in the Schrodinger equation, as you know, if you just have these upspin and downspin, and you have these two component, so the wave function has two components. I'll call them U and D, up and down. This is two components. Right? So we are thinking of this special case, you know, a real small device where you just have one level there. I mean, actually two levels, an upspin and a downspin. That's how you're thinking. And we have put a little magnetic field there. So the Hamiltonian actually looks something like, and I've put a magnetic field in the Z direction. So the Hamiltonian looks like so my question is that if an electron came in, polarized in a particular direction, as it goes through the device, what will happen to it? So if initially you had this up-down in some particular direction, let's say it's the x direction, so one up-down would be like 1-1, something like that. As it goes through the device, what will happen? That's what you want to figure out. Now, this is an equation that I'd argue that you can write down the solution in a minute, really. Why is that? Well, because it's diagonal, so it's really two separate differential equations. Because you've got one equation which looks like d up is equal to mu b bz times u, right? So can you tell me the solution to this? So if I claim that if I tell you what the up component is at time 0, you can tell me easily what it is at time t. It's just exponential mu b bz divided by I h bar times time. So with time, what happens is that the up component magnitude stays the same, the phase just keeps changing. Okay. Now, what about the down component? So, because when I look at the equation for the down component, it's exactly the same except that instead of plus 1, we have a minus 1 there. That's about it. So its phase will also change, but just in the opposite direction, right? That's it. So one thing you can see is that if you had a spin that was in the positive z direction, which means if it was something that looked like 1, 0 in the first place, you know, 1, 0 means something that is upspin along z. So if it is upspin along z, then at a later time, it will still look like 1, 0, except that there would be a phase factor to this. Now, that, of course, doesn't change the actual wave function, because overall, if you multiply by a phase factor, it doesn't matter. It's this relative phase that matters. Because finally, remember, when you calculate electron density or any observable, you'll take psi star. That overall phase really doesn't matter. So what this tells you is that if you had a spin along z direction, 1, 0, nothing much would happen to it with time. And that's very true. That is, if you put a magnetic field along z and the original spin is also along z, nothing happens. It just stays there. The point I'm trying to show is if we come in with something along x and the magnetic field is along z, then indeed something will happen. And the way you see that is, well, if the initial state is 1, 1, for example, that corresponds to a spin along 1, 1 would be a spin that points along x. Okay? No. This is, of course, the basic thing. X means theta is 90 degrees, so it's cosine 45, sine 45. That's like 1, 1. And 1, 1 divided by root 2. Okay. So if it is 1, 1, then you see with time, the spin keeps changing. Why? Because one component acquires a phase of one type, and the other acquires the opposite phase. So now you can see something's happening. You see, it's not the same spinner after a while. The two components have changed. Well, how have they changed? Well, basically, one has picked up a phase turning one way, the other has picked up a phase the other way. And if you look at this, you can see what that means. The two phases are changing. So basically, the way you can visualize what is happening is as if the phi is changing with time. Really? And you can see what... how you'd write it. You could say that phi is equal to, you know, this is minus I phi over 2. That's like this quantity. So can you help me with what's phi? Mu b bz by h bar time and x. And I think we're missing a factor. The 2, because this is phi over 2, right? So phi over 2 is mu b bz over h bar times And the minus I, you know, that's minus I. This I is in the denominator, so that's also minus I, really. So this is it. So then what you're getting from Schrodinger equation then, what it's really telling you is, if you come in with any spinner, what will happen is phi, which basically tells you the angle around this z-axis, you know, how it is rotating in the xy plane. So basically, if you had a spin that was pointing this way, what will happen is the theta will stay fixed, but it will rotate around like this, because the phi will just keep changing with time. That's what this is telling you. Because this tells you that, you know, phi is changing with time according to this. And as I said, that then represents a spinner, you know, whose direction phi is changing. Because the point I tried to make earlier is that these are, in a way, two different ways of representing a particular direction in a pointing, in something pointing in a particular direction, theta phi. What you learned in first year college was how to represent it as a vector with three real components. And here what we're using is something that, a representation where you got two complex components. Okay? And when you're visualizing it, when you're writing it, you're writing two complex things. But when you're visualizing it, you're usually visualizing it as a vector. Okay? Now, the thing is that if instead of plus one, if instead of bz, I had used, say, bx, question is what would have happened? And the answer is, well, you see, if I had put bx here, for example, then as you know, this would have been 0, 1, 1, 0. And now it would be a little, it would take a little more work to figure out exactly how the spin rotates. But what you can see is essentially what will happen is the spin will now rotate around the x-axis. Why is that? The quickest way to see that is, I'll say, okay, it looks like this, but why don't we go to a basis using plus x and minus x as our basis functions? Because then what would happen is, instead of looking like this, this matrix would have looked like 1, 0, 0, minus 1. You see, what I'm saying is, it looks like this only because I like to use z and minus z as my basis. But if I had used x and minus x as my basis, then magnetic field in the x direction would have looked like this. And then, of course, the algebra would have been exactly the same as before. And in the process, what you would have shown is that the spinner rotates around the x-axis. So the basic result is that whenever you have a magnetic field in a certain direction, a spin wants to rotate around that as your axis. Like so. And so if you put a magnetic field in the x direction, it will rotate this way. And that is a little more complicated to describe because now it's kind of like, you know, theta is changing, phi is changing. It's not so easy if you want to elucidate that. But you can see that by changing basis, you would get that answer right away. Anyway. So basic point is, yeah, it will, okay. Now, often what people do is, instead of using this equation, which is in terms of the up and down components, they think of the spin as a vector whose so let's say we go back to what we had. Bz. So what we have here is a vector. And what you'd like to write here is a matrix that describes exactly the same physics as this. Namely, what does this describe? This describes, we said, that the spinner, how it rotates around Bz. Now, supposing we think of this as spins, so that as vectors, which has components x, y, and z. So my question then is, what would be this matrix? Let me write this here. Can you help? How can we go about writing this matrix? What you're saying is, okay, this equation involves these spinor components, these complex components and all that. But I would like to visualize it as a vector. So let me try to write an equivalent thing so that, you know, this would be easier for me to think in terms of. This would be like the old vectors that we learned in first year college. So how do you get that? Well, one way to say it is, let's look at what is dSx dt, for example. So Sx, that's this component. So supposing I take the ddt of this component. So if I take the ddt of this component, what you'll get is, remember, theta is fixed, only the phi is changing. So cosine phi, when I take its derivative, I get minus sine phi, and then I get d phi dt. And d phi dt, of course, I know from here already. I know that it is changing with time at 2 mu b bz over h bar. So this is 2 mu b bz over h bar. So any thoughts on what this matrix should look like then? So I'm trying to fill out this first line of the matrix. This is dSx dt is equal to, I'm trying to fill out this line. You know, that will tell me that dSx dt is equal to something times Sx plus something times Sy plus something times Sz. So what are these elements? Can you help me? Given that dSx, you know, this is Sx, and dSx dt is this. So what is this? Is this Sx, Sy, or Sz? Sy. So what you expect then is, we have something like this, 0, minus 1, 0. And of course, this big constant number in front. With a 2 there, that's it. Say this again?
It will appear again if you click on this one, right?
So here we had mu b bz, I h bar here. Now it is 2 mu b bz, no i's. This h bar. These are all real things. So can you help me with the next line, the dSy dt? So when I take dSi dt, it get the ddt of sine phi, which is like cosine phi, and that's like Sx. So you tend to pick up a 1 here, 0 here, 0. And what about dSz dt? All zeros. It's not changing at all. That's it. Yes. Where we are going with this? Okay. Overall, where we are going is, okay, so the logic of this whole thing is, we started with this spin components, up and down components, two complex components, and we said this is Schrodinger equation. And I want to know, what does the Schrodinger equation tell me a spin will do in a magnetic field in the z direction? And we found that what it does is, the phi keeps changing with time this way. And as I've said, these spins you could visualize as your familiar vectors also from first year college. And so what we are now saying is, instead of the Schrodinger equation, could I have written an equation directly for that vector? Okay? And what we are saying is, okay, this vector should do it, because this also will tell me that phi is changing with time according to this. So as long as I have done, you know, put this thing correctly with the factor of 2 and all that, this equation will tell me for the vector exactly what Schrodinger equation tells me for the spinor. That's as far as we have come. Right? And often people, when they're just trying to describe spins in a magnetic field or describing the dynamics of magnets, they often use this equation. You go from here. They say, okay, there is a vector in a magnetic field. This is how the magnetization will rotate. And in a magnet, of course, there are other things you have to put in, like because of the interaction between spins and all that. But the starting point is something like this. This with some other terms then becomes the equation that describes how a magnet behaves in a magnetic field, for example, separate. But this one, sometimes people write in a more compact way this way. It goes this ddt of s. This is a, I put this, this is like a unit vector s in a certain direction, is equal to this 2 mu b bz over h bar. Actually, in the general rule is something like this. It will be 2 mu b over h bar times s cross b. What I claim is that that matrix is actually finally basically a cross product. Let's see if that works. I'm saying this is just like really the same as that. Because what we did here is we assumed that a magnetic field was in the z direction. Now, if you're in the z direction, then S cross B amounts to, if B is purely in the z direction, what is S cross B? You know, it's like S cross Z. So you'll get, yes, go ahead. And we are looking for the x component of this. So let's say we are trying to write the first line. So let us say this is in the z direction, and we are trying to get the x component. So you'll get a sy. Right? So sybz, that will be like the, and that's exactly what you have here, sybz. You know, sy there, bz there. Except that I missed a minus sign. So actually the correct equation is this with a minus sign here. So that's the equation that you see often. It's called, I think this is, yeah, this is what you'd call the Bloch equation. The Bloch equation has an additional term they put in, but basically this would be it. Okay. So in terms of vectors, this is how often people write it. They say, okay, if you had a spin in a certain direction and you put a magnetic field, it obeys this, and that is equivalent to saying that the spin will rotate. I mean, the dynamics of this will tell you that the spin will rotate around the magnetic field. And all I'm trying to show you is that that vector obeying this equation and this spinner obeying Schrodinger equation will describe much the same thing mathematically. And of course, we only worked with a magnetic field in the z direction. With x and y also, you could write down similar matrices. It just takes a little more work. But and of course, if you accept this, then just from the cross product, you can write those down. So there are these corresponding matrices here that you could put. So let me call this, say, SZ matrix, which looked like, what did I have? I guess 0, minus 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And but the thing, one thing to remember is there's two here, and this was an idea. And if you had tried to write a corresponding thing for sy, you'd have got something like this. There'll be sy and sx. So, for example, when you write minus 6, I think you'll get this. So this is the one that causes you to rotate around the z-axis. This was rotating around the y-axis, rotating around the x-axis for spinors. For the corresponding vectors, you'd have matrices like this. That would make you rotate. And these matrices, if you accept this cross product thing, you can see how it comes about. The same reason why SZ a minus 1, 1 here, SY gives you a minus 1 and a 1 there, and SX gives you a minus 1 and a 1 there. That's about it. So those are the matrices that would rotate the vectors. That's all. Okay. Now, a couple of points I wanted to make here is that this basic fact that I mentioned has to do with this Hanley effect. Is that when you have a magnetic field in a certain direction, the spin wants to rotate around it with this. So what you might try to estimate is, will I see a significant effect in going through a device? In other words, when I come in here, will it just rotate by half a degree, or will it actually rotate by 90 degrees or 180 degrees, you know, something observable? How much magnetic field do I need to get it to actually rotate significantly? So that you can figure out from, you know, the amount it rotates is phi equals 2 mu b, b over h bar times time. Now, how much is this? I think last day we went through an estimate that if you have 1 Tesla here, this comes to like 0.1 millivolts or so. Let's put in the numbers roughly. So 2 mu b, that's the Bohr magneton, that I think I'd said last day was 10 to the minus 23 in MKS units. B, let's say for the moment, 1 Tesla. Actually, usually people often put far smaller magnetic fields, like 100 Gauss or so, which is actually a hundredth of a Tesla. So let's put 0.01. 0.01 Tesla. So this is all MKS units. And then H bar is 1.06 times 10 to the minus 34 times T. So roughly speaking, what you have here then is about 10 to the 9 or so. 2 times 10 to the 9th, roughly. So what that means is you'll see a sizable effect if the electron is traveling for a length of time that's like a nanosecond. If this was a nanosecond, then of course between them they would give you a sizable turning, because this is in radians, so if you get 2, it means 2 radians, not 2 degrees. Right? And 2 radians is an observable thing then. Right. So what you need is something where the electron has about a nanosecond then, if you are using a 100 Gauss field. If you used a 1,000 Gauss field, 1 kilogauss, then of course you could do with a shorter length of time. So if this was 0.1, then this could have been just 0.1 nanosecond, and you'd still have. So how much time do you have here? Well, usually it is like the transit time through the device. So if this device was, say, a micron long, the transit times would easily be, I guess we could try this out. Roughly speaking, I think if you have, say, 1 micrometer, and typical speeds in semiconductors would be like 10 to the 5th meters per second, let's say. 10 to the 5th, sometimes 10 to the 6th, on that order, the biggest velocities. So if you do that, I think you get 10 to the minus 11 seconds. So if you're going for a 1 micron, then I think this is coming to 10 to the minus 11 seconds, which would mean that you'd need a somewhat bigger magnetic field to actually get a sizable rotation. Now, I might say, well, why 1 micron? We could make it hundreds of microns long. Yes, but if you made it very long, you wouldn't see anything. And that the reason for that is it doesn't matter how good your material is and all that. There is always all kinds of processes in your material, all kinds of scattering processes that wants to destroy the spin information. I mean, something that's not in your equation yet, right here. So when you come in with a spin like this, after 1 micron, it still remembers how it came in. The information's still there. But by the time you have gone 1 millimeter, you really don't know which way it points, because it's got scattered from all kinds of things. Just some little magnetic impurity here and there, it'll scatter it. You're going through, you know, millions of atoms. Somewhere you'll get scattered enough that the information won't be there anymore. So that way there is an upper limit to how long this time can be. You cannot just make your device longer and do it. That's this, what they call the spin coherence length. So when people are doing this, trying to come up with good materials for this, most important thing, of course, is to get good contacts. You know, things that will give you a significant difference between an alpha and a beta. But then the other issue they talk about is the spin coherence length. You know, how far can you go without getting scattered? All two. And that silicon is actually quite good. Carbon is even better. So all the carbon-based things are better than that, etc. Anyway, so that's this Handley effect, which has actually been observed in, you know, even silicon devices. In metals, it has been observed a long time. But lately, I think I've seen papers where they actually see this in silicon also. And it consists of just a device like this with magnetic contacts. And then you put a magnetic field, and what happens is the current actually oscillates with time, as you change the magnetic field, as a function of the magnetic field. So, and one thing I've often stressed, that, you know, you're doing here a lot of fancy math, you know, and things that are somewhat new to you. And often what you wonder is, how real is this? And the thing is, you always have to do this reality check against experiments. Now, of course, many of these equations, they were developed like 70 years ago. And at that time, people did very difficult experiments in vacuum and came up with the results and found the math needed to describe it. But today, of course, as I said, using that knowledge, we are designing devices, you know, solid-state devices that are actually showing these same effects. And so today, if you had to say, well, how do I know any of this is right? You know, how do I know that I really need to think about spins and not just vectors? Well, I'd say if you take a device like this and we had a parallel configuration, and if you think of it as vectors, then you'd have said that the way you get minimum current is by making this magnet orthogonal to that one. Right? Because after all, if this was light, and you think of this as a polarizer and that as an analyzer, then the way you stop the light, you say, well, the light that came in looks like this, and then if I make it orthogonal, it won't be able to get out. Experimental fact is, not really. You turn it around all the way, and that's when the current will be minimum, the anti-parallel configuration. So clearly you need a different math if you are going to think of spins as the polarization. Because if it was just vectors, then with light, if your analyzer was this way and you got a lot of light going through, if you turn it around, it will still go through. If you want to stop it, it has to be 90 degrees. And that math, of course, is right here. The fact that these are theta and phi, whereas these are half theta and half phi. That's it. Which is why turning something by 180 degrees really amounts to turning the equivalent vector by only 90 degrees. And that is how the algebra works. So this math really describes it, you know, quite well. That's what I'm saying. Now, how did people come up with this? Well, that's where I'd say, you know, because I kind of did it backwards. In the sense I said, well, if you accept this, you can see how all the rest of it. But how did they come up with it? Well, they say that this is where I think if you read the standard quantum mechanics text, they'd usually start from what they call this group theoretical description. And the basic thing they say is that these matrices that we have and these matrices that you have, you know, they don't even look similar. You wonder how they can be describing the similar objects. But there's one very important attribute that's the same with both of them, and that is you can do a little algebra and show that these matrices have the property that Sx Sy minus Sy Sx is equal to Sz. In other words, these matrices don't commute. And if you rotate something along X and along Y, or if you rotate it first along Y and then along X, there is a difference, and the difference is equal to that. That's what it says. And the thing is, these matrices also have the same property. Actually, not exactly, because there's this factor of 2 and that factor of I. So if you did it right, actually, this would be divided by 2i. But including that, they have exactly that same property. And mathematically, what you'd say is that these matrices need to have that property in order to describe the algebra of rotations correctly. So if you took a standard quantum mechanics course or looked at any of those books, the way they would say is, okay, for vectors we know this. If you are trying to create a two-component object, which you can rotate in a consistent way, the first step is find three matrices which obey this algebra. First thing. So first thing is you come out with these matrices. And then you say, okay, the eigenvectors of this matrix basically represent upspin and downspin along x. Eigenvectors of the, because that means you, when you rotate around x, nothing happens to it. Up, eigenvectors of this one tells you the upspin and downspin along y. Eigenvectors of this tells you upspin and downspin along z. And in the general situation, if you took sigma dot a vector in some arbitrary direction, then its eigenvectors would look like this. And that's what would, so that is how it's usually done in a quantum mechanics text, you see. It would go first by saying, in order to describe rotatable objects, it needs to obey that algebra, so write these matrices, and take those matrices, find its eigenvectors, and that's this. Whereas I kind of did the whole thing backwards. I said, well, if you give me this, I'll show you all the rest of it, how it goes. Okay? So let me stop here today.